Welcome to this week's Ortho Digest Weekly Rundown for the week of April 6, 2026. We're covering 30 studies across arthroplasty, hand, pediatrics, shoulder, elbow, basic science, spine, and sports. Let's start with our first study. Rios and colleagues published in JSES titled Effect of Lateralization and Distalization on Tuberosity Healing and Functional Outcomes After Reverse Total Shoulder Arthroplasty with the Universe Reverse Total Shoulder System for Proximal Humerus Fractures. This randomized controlled trial enrolled 79 patients, with 76 completing two-year follow-up, 38 per group. They compared tuberosity healing and functional outcomes between 135-degree lateralized and 155-degree distalized uncemented reverse total shoulder stem in patients 65 and older with 3- or 4-part proximal humerus fractures or displaced 2-part fractures with osteoporosis or rotator cuff tears. One limitation: radiographic assessment alone without CT confirmation limits accuracy of healing classification. The 155-degree distalized stem configuration produced a 4-fold lower risk of greater tuberosity non-healing compared to the 135-degree lateralized stem, 8% versus 32%, with a relative risk of 4.0 and 95% confidence interval of 1.23 to 13.05. Moving on, Strickler and colleagues published in JOS a scoping review titled Preoperative GLP-1 Receptor Agonist Use and Postoperative Outcomes in Orthopedic Surgery, a scoping review of perioperative and recovery outcomes. They synthesized evidence from 35 studies published between 2015 and 2025 on preoperative GLP-1 receptor agonist exposure across arthroplasty, spine, trauma, foot and ankle, shoulder, and soft tissue procedures. This extends the perioperative arthroplasty optimization literature by demonstrating that GLP-1 receptor agonist exposure does not increase and may reduce periprosthetic joint infection and readmission risk, challenging the assumption that delayed gastric emptying and metabolic effects confer net perioperative harm. One limitation: no included study standardized GLP-1 receptor agonist agent, dose, or perioperative hold duration, making it impossible to determine whether outcome differences are drug class effects, dose dependent, or confounded by indication. Across 35 studies, preoperative GLP-1 receptor agonist use was associated with similar or lower 90-day complications in arthroplasty, including reduced periprosthetic joint infection rates, while spine surgery showed mixed signals, including increased pneumonia, acute kidney injury, and pseudarthrosis with prolonged semaglutide exposure. Moving on, Bram and colleagues published in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery a case control study titled Greater Valgus Alignment in Pediatric and Adolescent Patients with a Primary Anterior Cruciate Ligament Tear Compared with Healthy Controls. They enrolled 200 patients, 100 cases, and 100 age and sex matched controls, and asked whether coronal plane alignment differs between pediatric ACL tear patients and healthy controls using preoperative hip to ankle radiographs. This extends prior adult literature linking valgus alignment to ACL injury risk. One limitation: the cross-sectional design precludes causal inference. It's unknown whether valgus alignment is a pre-existing risk factor for ACL injury or a consequence of altered loading mechanics following ACL deficiency. Pediatric ACL tear patients demonstrated significantly greater valgus alignment than matched controls, with each 1-degree increase in hip knee ankle angle valgus increasing ACL tear odds by 14%, odds ratio 1.14, with a 95% confidence interval of 1.2 to 1.27. Moving on, Martinez and colleagues published in JOS a retrospective cohort titled What is the Role of American College of Surgeons National Surgical Quality Improvement Program's Risk Calculator in Fracture Surgery? They enrolled 767 patients with 790 distal radius fractures and compared ACS-NSQFP predicted complication rates against observed rates from a prospectively enrolled institutional database spanning May 2000 to May 2020. This extends prior work by Nwosu and colleagues. One limitation: the comparison conflates NSQIP's strictly defined 30-day window with an undefined long-term institutional follow-up period, making the magnitude of underestimation appear larger than a true apples-to-apples comparison would support. ACS-NSQIP predicted a 1.85% any complication rate for distal radius open reduction and internal fixation, but observed long-term hand-related complications reached 27.72%, a 15-fold underestimation. Moving on, Kim and colleagues published in the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics a prospective cohort titled Lower Extremity Above Ankle Fractures are Associated with Significantly Lower Serum 25-Hydroxyvitamin D Levels and Lower Vitamin D Sufficiency Compared to Upper Extremity and Ankle Foot Fractures. They enrolled 156 pediatric patients, ages 3 to 18, 64 upper extremity, 52 lower extremity above ankle, and 40 ankle and foot, and compared serum 25-hydroxyvitamin D levels across fracture sites. This extends prior work by demonstrating that fracture site, not simply fracture occurrence, is a meaningful stratifier of vitamin D status and supports screening all pediatric fracture patients given deficiency rates of 30% or greater across all groups. One limitation: the absence of a matched healthy control group prevents determination of whether low vitamin D predisposes to these fractures or is simply a population-level finding unrelated to fracture causation. Pediatric lower extremity above ankle fractures presented with mean serum 25-hydroxyvitamin D of 18.9 nanograms per milliliter versus 25.7 nanograms per milliliter in upper extremity fractures, with 58% meeting deficiency criteria of less than 20 nanograms per milliliter compared to 30% in upper extremity and ankle and foot groups. Moving on, Bitar and colleagues published in JSES a prospective cohort titled Outcomes of Arthroscopic versus Open Bankart Repair in Collision Athletes Following a First Episode of Anterior Shoulder Dislocation, a 5-year prospective cohort study. They enrolled 80 collision athletes, 30 years or younger, 40 per group, with a first episode anterior dislocation, on-track Hill-Sachs lesions, and glenoid bone loss of 13% or less. Mean follow-up was 68.9 months for open Bankart plus inferior capsular shift and 70.5 months for isolated arthroscopic Bankart repair. This extends the ISIS score framework by isolating a high-risk subgroup where ISIS would predict intermediate to high recurrence risk and demonstrates that open capsular shift substantially reduces that risk even with on-track lesions and minimal bone loss. One limitation: non-randomized group allocation is the critical flaw. Unmeasured confounders such as sport type, ISIS score distribution, and surgeon preference could account for the recurrence difference independent of the procedure itself. Open Bankart plus inferior capsular shift reduced recurrence to 2.5% versus 17.5% with isolated arthroscopic Bankart repair in collision athletes after a first dislocation with P equals 0.03 and equivalent functional scores, range of motion, and return to sport rates at 5 years. Moving on, Taylor and colleagues published in the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics a retrospective cohort titled The Proximal Humerus Ossification System Predicts Surgical Curve Progression in Unbraced Patients with Adolescent Idiopathic Scoliosis. They enrolled 164 patients and derived a prognostic model using proximal humerus ossification system, major curve angle, and thoracic apex presence to predict progression to surgical indications in unbraced AIS patients. This extends the BRACE trial by providing a quantitative baseline surgical progression risk score using FOSS that can stratify patients prior to bracing decisions rather than simply describing bracing outcomes. One limitation: the model was derived and tested in the same 164 patient cohort without external validation, so reported performance metrics are optimistic and cannot yet be applied to independent clinical populations. A FOSS-based prognostic model predicts surgical curve progression in unbraced AIS patients with a C statistic of 0.89 and negative predictive value of 0.94, performing equivalently to a RISR-based model. Moving on, Rodriguez and colleagues published in the Spine Journal a prospective cohort titled Deterioration in Clinical Outcomes in Patients with Lumbar Spinal Stenosis 12 Years Following Surgery. They enrolled 211 patients, 98 completed 12-year patient-reported outcome and radiographic follow-up at a median of 12 years with a range of 9 to 15 years. This prospective observational study examined patient-reported outcomes and radiographic parameters in surgically treated lumbar stenosis patients, comparing the 26% who required revision surgery to those who did not. This extends the SPORT trial, which demonstrated sustained surgical benefit at 4 years by showing that functional gains erode by 12 years while pain relief partially persists. It also extends Debo's 2024 work by demonstrating that pelvic incidence minus lumbar lordosis mismatch greater than 10 degrees is associated with revision surgery in a stenosis-specific long-term cohort. One limitation: the 54% attrition rate at 12 years introduces significant survivorship bias, as patients lost to follow-up likely include those with the worst outcomes, meaning functional deterioration and revision rates are probably underestimated. At 12-year follow-up after lumbar stenosis surgery, 26% of patients required revision, and the revision cohort demonstrated clinically worse pelvic incidence minus lumbar lordosis mismatch of 16 degrees versus 10 degrees, and lumbar lordosis of 41 degrees versus 47 degrees compared to non-revision patients. Moving on, Lin and colleagues published in JS a biomechanical study titled Biomechanical Optimization of Pediatric Supracondylar Humerus Fracture Fixation, Insights from an Experimental Study and Network Meta-Analysis. This two-part study evaluated biomechanical performance of 5 fixation configurations for pediatric supracondylar humerus fractures via cyclic loading and load-to-failure testing, supplemented by a network meta-analysis of 12 published biomechanical studies. This extends the body of clinical comparative studies on lateral versus crossed pin fixation. One limitation, the network meta-analysis pools heterogeneous biomechanical models without standardization, limiting the validity of cross-study rankings. In a combined biomechanical study and network meta-analysis, the two divergent lateral plus one medial pin configuration ranked highest across varus stiffness with sucra of 99.7%, valgus stiffness of 92.9%, and torsional failure torque with sucra of 100% for pediatric supracondylar humerus fracture fixation. Moving on, Van and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research a retrospective cohort titled Preliminary Surgical Findings and Complications After National Centralization of Pediatric Bone Sarcoma Resections in the Netherlands, a benchmarking study. They enrolled 99 patients, 70% osteosarcoma and 25% Ewing sarcoma, with median follow-up of 18 months and 90-day outcomes as the primary endpoint. This benchmarking study evaluated short-term perioperative outcomes following national centralization of all pediatric bone sarcoma resections at a single Dutch tertiary center from 2018 to 2024. This extends the established standard for osteosarcoma and Ewing sarcoma by providing the first national-level centralization benchmark for pediatric bone sarcoma, quantifying that centralized care achieves 94% R0 margins and limits chemotherapy delay to 7% of patients. One limitation, median follow-up of only 18 months precludes reporting of oncologic outcomes such as local recurrence and survival, which are the primary determinants of centralization's long-term value. After national centralization of pediatric bone sarcoma surgery in the Netherlands, R0 margins were achieved in 94% of 99 patients, with 22% experiencing a 30-day complication and only 7% experiencing chemotherapy delay beyond 28 days. Moving on, Leonetti and colleagues published in the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics a retrospective cohort titled Comparative Outcomes of MIPO versus ESINE in Complex Pediatric Tibial Fractures, Diaphyseal AO Foundation 42BC, and Extraarticular Distal AO Foundation 43A2A3. They enrolled 58 patients, 25 with minimally invasive plate osteosynthesis, and 33 with elastic stable intramedullary nailing, ages 6 to 15 years, with AO Foundation 42BC, diaphyseal or 43A2A3, extra-articular distal tibial fractures over 7 years. Union and return to sport endpoints were captured at 10.6 and 13.3 weeks, respectively, for MIPO. This extends the age-based femoral shaft management literature by demonstrating that fracture morphology, not age or bone alone, should drive implant selection in pediatric long bone fixation. It also challenges the default use of ESINE for all pediatric tibial fractures by showing a 24% unplanned reoperation rate in ESINE for complex patterns versus 0% with MIPO. One limitation, the 24% unplanned reoperation rate in the ESINE group likely reflects selection of more inherently unstable fractures for that technique. And without randomization or propensity matching, the superior MIPO outcomes cannot be attributed to the implant alone. In complex pediatric tibial fractures, MIPO achieved radiographic union 5.2 weeks faster than ESINE, 10.6 versus 15.8 weeks, with p less than 0.001, and eliminated unplanned reoperations at 0% versus 24%. Moving on, Lee and colleagues published in JSES a retrospective cohort titled Impact of Cement Use and Stem Length on Clinical Outcomes in Revision Reverse Shoulder Arthroplasty is a short stem with cementless fixation a viable option. They enrolled 113 patients with minimum 2-year follow-up and compared clinical outcomes of revision RSA stratified by humeral stem fixation method. This extends prior work by Fraser and colleagues by demonstrating that short cementless stems are a viable humeral fixation strategy, specifically in the revision RSA setting where bone stock is compromised. One limitation, the short stem cohort is underpowered to detect clinically meaningful differences in complication and re-revision rates, making the 0% re-revision finding unreliable for practice-changing conclusions. In revision reverse total shoulder arthroplasty, short cementless stems achieved constant score improvement of 23.5 points versus 3.5 points for long stems, with p equals 0.02 and a 0% humeral stem re-revision rate at minimum 2-year follow-up. Moving on, Wallace and colleagues published in JOA a database study titled Does a 36mm head increase cumulative revision rate in total hip arthroplasty when compared to a 32mm head? A study from the Australian Orthopaedic Association National Joint Replacement Registry. This AOA-NJR registry study compared cumulative percent revision between 32mm and 36mm ceramic and metal heads on highly cross-linked polyethylene in primary total hip arthroplasty across 272,258 procedures from September 1999 to December 2022. This extends prior AONJR analysis reporting reduced dislocation with 36mm versus smaller heads by demonstrating that the dislocation benefit is offset by significantly higher fracture and loosening revision rates, a trade-off not previously quantified at this scale. One limitation: the registry does not capture combined anaversion, femoral offset, or cup version, making it impossible to determine whether the increased fracture and loosening risk with 36mm heads reflects head size biomechanics or systematic differences in component positioning. 36mm femoral heads carry a 14% higher all-cause revision hazard versus 32mm heads. Hazard ratio 1.14, with 95% confidence interval 1.08 to 1.20 in primary total hip arthroplasty, driven by increased fracture with hazard ratio 1.30 and loosening with hazard ratio 1.21, revisions that outweigh the dislocation benefit. Moving on, Klein and colleagues published in JSES a retrospective cohort titled Incidence and Risk Factors for Aseptic Glenoid Baseplate Loosening in Primary Reverse Shoulder Arthroplasty using the Aramis Implant Baseplate with a minimum of 2 years follow-up. They enrolled 194 patients with mean follow-up of 4.2 years, ranging from 2 to 9.3 years. This retrospective multicenter study examined aseptic glenoid baseplate loosening incidence and risk factors in primary reverse total shoulder arthroplasty cases using the Aramis lateralized glenoid and lateralized humerus convex baseplate implant. This extends prior work on baseplate fixation failure risk factors by identifying excessive lateralization angle specific to lateralized glenoid designs as an independent predictor, a variable not previously quantified in studies examining standard medialized baseplate configurations. One limitation: only 11 aseptic glenoid baseplate loosening events in 194 cases produces an underpowered multivariable model with extremely wide confidence intervals, making the independent effect estimates statistically unstable and potentially ungeneralizable. Aseptic glenoid baseplate loosening occurred in 5.7% of Aramis reverse total shoulder arthroplasty cases at mean 4.2 years, independently predicted by intraoperative glenoid fracture with odds ratio 15 and excessive lateral component positioning with odds ratio 1.07 per degree. Moving on, Rudisill and colleagues published in JOA a retrospective cohort titled Primary Total Hip Arthroplasty in Patients Who Have Morbid Obesity, a propensity-weighted analysis of dual mobility and standard fixed-bearing implants. They enrolled 1,012 patients, 69 with dual mobility and 943 with fixed bearing, with mean follow-up of 6.0 years ranging from 2.0 to 17.2 years. This study compared dual mobility versus fixed bearing total hip arthroplasty outcomes in patients with body mass index greater than 40 using a single institution registry and propensity-weighted Kaplan-Meier analysis. Boyer's 22-year dual mobility follow-up data extends to the morbid obesity subpopulation, demonstrating that dual mobility's stability advantage is preserved in this mechanically demanding cohort without an increase in non-operative complications. One limitation: the dual mobility cohort is too small to detect statistically significant differences in revision or instability rates, and the non-significant p-values preclude definitive conclusions despite favorable point estimates. In morbidly obese patients with body mass index greater than 40 undergoing primary total hip arthroplasty, dual mobility implants achieved 100% five-year survivorship free from revision versus 96.8% for fixed-bearing constructs, with instability rates of 1.4% versus 0.6%. Moving on, Rajkovic and colleagues published in the Spine Journal a retrospective cohort titled Infectious Complications of Stereotactic Navigation in Posterior or Posterolateral Thoracic and Lumbar Spinal Fusion and Posterior Lumbar Interbody Fusion for Degenerative Spinal Disease, an ACS-NSQIP study. They used ACS-NSQIP data from 2015 to 2020 to compare 30-day infectious complications between navigation-assisted and conventional posterior thoracic and lumbar fusion, posterolateral fusion, and posterior lumbar interbody fusion for degenerative pathology across 150,570 patients, 7,537 with navigation, and 108,033 without navigation. This extends the existing literature on navigation safety by introducing infection as an independent risk outcome. Prior navigation studies have focused on pedicle screw accuracy and radiation reduction. One limitation: NSQIP's 30-day follow-up window captures only early infections and cannot detect delayed deep surgical site infection or implant-related infections that commonly present beyond 1 month in instrumented fusion cases. Stereotactic navigation in posterior thoracic and lumbar fusion and posterior lumbar interbody fusion was independently associated with higher odds of superficial surgical site infection and overall postoperative infection at 30 days after controlling for operative time, frailty, and revision status in 150,570 patients. Moving on, Corbin and colleagues published in JSES a retrospective cohort titled Return to Sport After Shoulder Arthroplasty, an ASS multicenter analysis of sport-specific predictors of performance in reverse shoulder arthroplasty and total shoulder arthroplasty. This multicenter ASS study across 17 U.S. centers enrolled 961 patients with 537 sport participants and 656 sport participations, with mean follow-up of 24.0 plus or minus 8.1 months. This extends prior single-institution return to sport series in shoulder arthroplasty by providing multicenter, sport-specific performance data across seven activities and demonstrating that reverse total shoulder arthroplasty achieves non-inferior or superior sport outcomes compared to anatomic TSA and glenohumeral osteoarthritis, challenging the assumption that anatomic reconstruction is preferable for active patients. One limitation: the study lacks objective preoperative and postoperative sport performance measures, making it impossible to distinguish true performance recovery from patient-perceived adaptation to a lower functional baseline. 89.2% of shoulder arthroplasty patients returned to sport, with 80.2% reporting maintained or improved performance. And reverse total shoulder arthroplasty demonstrated superior sport performance stability versus anatomic TSA in matched glenohumeral osteoarthritis patients, 87.9% versus 78.9% with p equals 0.04. Moving on, Dee and colleagues published in JOA a systematic review and meta-analysis titled The Role of Stem Shape and Geometry in Revision and Complication Risk Following Primary Total Hip Arthroplasty, a systematic review and meta-analysis. They analyzed 18 studies encompassing 51,375 stems, 12,969 anatomic, 17,115 single taper, 19,326 single wedge, and 1,965 taper wedge published from 2015 to 2025. This systematic review and meta-analysis compared revision and complication rates across four femoral stem geometries in primary total hip arthroplasty. This extends the AOJR annual reports by synthesizing international data across four geometric categories and quantifying relative complication risks for instability, periprosthetic joint infection, aseptic loosening, and periprosthetic fracture simultaneously. One limitation: the analysis does not account for indication-driven stem selection bias. Anatomic stems are disproportionately used in dysplastic or deformed femora, which independently elevate complication risk and confound the between-group comparisons. Anatomic femoral stems carry the highest overall revision rate of 3.9% in primary total hip arthroplasty, while single-wedge stems demonstrate the lowest relative revision risk with relative risk 0.31 and periprosthetic fracture risk with relative risk 0.21 compared to anatomic designs. Moving on, ACES and colleagues published in JSES a retrospective cohort titled Surgical and Patient Factors Associated with Base Plate Failures After Reverse Shoulder Arthroplasty, a study by the ASES Complications of RSA Multicenter Research Group. This ASES multicenter retrospective study across 15 U.S. centers enrolled 5,049 patients, 83 with base plate failures versus 4,966 controls, with median 72 weeks to failure and minimum 3-month follow-up required for inclusion. This extends prior work by Zumstein and colleagues. One limitation: radiographic failure definition likely underestimates true failure incidence by excluding early fibrous fixation or subtle loosening without gross displacement. Base plate failure occurred in 1.6% of 5,049 reverse total shoulder arthroplasty cases, with revision surgery as an independent predictor with odds ratio 4.57, bone graft use with odds ratio 2.81, and increased lateral offset with odds ratio 1.08 per millimeter, while central screw fixation was protective with odds ratio 0.55. Moving on, Schweizer and colleagues published in JOO a retrospective cohort titled Medial Unicompartmental Knee Arthroplasty for Osteonecrosis, a cohort study comparing cemented and cementless fixation. They enrolled 119 patients, 63 cemented and 56 cementless, with minimum 2-year follow-up and Kaplan-Meier analysis reported at 50 months. This retrospective single-center study compared cemented versus cementless medial mobile bearing unicompartmental knee arthroplasty in patients with knee osteonecrosis. This extends the Oxford Unicompartmental Knee Arthroplasty literature on osteonecrosis indications by demonstrating that cementless fixation achieves comparable short-term survival in this pathologically distinct subgroup. One limitation: the unbalanced sex distribution is uncontrolled and confounds direct comparison, as sex influences bone density, activity level, and implant loading patterns relevant to fixation outcomes. At 50 months, cementless medial mobile bearing unicompartmental knee arthroplasty for osteonecrosis achieved 97.7% survival free from aseptic loosening versus 100% for cemented fixation, with no statistically significant difference at p equals 0.35. Moving on. Lazzaro and colleagues published in JSES, a retrospective cohort titled Age Influences Lesser Tuberosity Osteotomy Non-Union Following Anatomic Total Shoulder Arthroplasty. They enrolled 449 patients and examined patient and technique-specific factors influencing lesser tuberosity osteotomy union after anatomic TSA with minimum 3-month radiographic follow-up. Prior series reporting lesser tuberosity osteotomy union rates of 83 to 97% are challenged by this study, which found a 33.4% non-union rate, suggesting prior estimates may reflect selection bias or shorter follow-up windows. One limitation, minimum 3-month radiographic follow-up without a standardized endpoint means many non-unions may represent delayed unions, artificially elevating the non-union rate. Lesser tuberosity osteotomy non-union occurred in 33.4% of anatomic TSA patients, with younger age as the only significant predictor with odds ratio 0.98 per year and p equals 0.04, yet only 2.7% of non-unions required revision surgery. Consider that younger patients may benefit from closer monitoring or alternative fixation strategies. Moving on, Chen and colleagues published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research a multi-center retrospective cohort titled Can Posterior Intervertebral Release Enhance the Correction Efficiency of Severe and Rigid Adult Idiopathic Scoliosis, a multi-center study with a minimum 2-year follow-up. They enrolled 176 patients, 84 with convex posterior intervertebral release plus SRS grade 2 osteotomy and 92 with SRS grade 2 osteotomy alone, with median follow-up of 27 to 28 months. This multi-center retrospective study asked whether adding convex posterior intervertebral release to SRS grade 2 osteotomy improves correction of major coronal curves greater than 80 degrees with flexibility less than 25% in adult idiopathic scoliosis. This extends prior SRS osteotomy classification literature by demonstrating that a convex soft tissue release adjunct to grade 2 osteotomy can achieve clinically meaningful incremental correction in the most rigid adult deformity cases, offering a middle ground strategy between standard posterior release and 3-column osteotomy. One limitation, intraoperative non-randomized allocation based on surgeon perception of residual rigidity, introduces unmeasurable selection bias that cannot be controlled retrospectively. Adding convex posterior intervertebral release to SRS grade 2 osteotomy achieved 14% greater coronal curve correction, 70% versus 56%, and tripled the odds of reaching minimum clinically important difference for self-image with odds ratio 3.0 in severe rigid adult idiopathic scoliosis without increasing operative time or blood loss. Moving on, Bake and colleagues published in JSES a retrospective cohort titled Is the graft position critical for functional outcomes following arthroscopy-assisted lower trapezius tendon transfer for posterosuperior irreparable rotator cuff tears? A comparison of anterior versus posterior position of graft. They enrolled 112 patients, 44 with anterior graft placement and 68 with posterior placement, with minimum 2-year follow-up. This study asked whether interpositional graft position on the humeral head footprint affects outcomes after arthroscopy-assisted lower trapezius transfer for posterosuperior irreparable rotator cuff tears. This extends the work of El Hassan and colleagues. One limitation, graft position was determined retrospectively from postoperative MRI rather than prospectively assigned, meaning posterior placement may be a surrogate for worse baseline tissue quality or more extensive tears rather than an independent variable. Anterior graft placement on the supraspinatus footprint in arthroscopy-assisted lower trapezius transfer yielded significantly greater postoperative forward elevation of 160.2 degrees versus 150.4 degrees, forward elevation strength of 27.4 versus 24.4 newtons per meter, and achievement of American shoulder and elbow surgeons minimum clinically important difference of 68.2% versus 45.6% compared to posterior placement. Moving on, Riley and colleagues published in JOA a retrospective cohort titled Risk Factors for the Development of Heterotopic Ossification After Conversion Total Hip Arthroplasty. They enrolled 75 hips and examined risk factors for heterotopic ossification development after conversion total hip arthroplasty from prior open reduction and internal fixation of acetabular fractures or intramedullary nailing of hip fractures at a single center. This extends the established heterotopic ossification literature in primary total hip arthroplasty by demonstrating that prior heterotopic ossification after index fracture fixation is the dominant modifiable risk predictor in the conversion total hip arthroplasty population, a subgroup not previously studied with this specificity. One limitation, the absence of reported follow-up duration and lack of standardized prophylaxis protocol across the cohort prevent determination of whether heterotopic ossification incidence or severity differed based on time from index procedure to conversion or prophylaxis agent used. Prior heterotopic ossification after index fixation confers a threefold increased risk of heterotopic ossification after conversion total hip arthroplasty, with an overall heterotopic ossification incidence of 33.3% in this cohort. Moving on, Choi and colleagues published in the Spine Journal a retrospective cohort titled Reevaluating the 50% Facetectomy Threshold in Posterior Cervical Foraminotomy, a Comparative Clinical and Radiographic Analysis. They enrolled 85 patients with 204 operated levels and two-year follow-up with interim assessment at 6 months. This study asked whether facet resection of 50% or greater during posterior cervical foraminotomy compromises clinical outcomes or radiographic stability compared to less than 50% resection. This extends the cadaveric biomechanical literature by providing the first comparative clinical cohort demonstrating that exceeding this threshold does not produce measurable instability or inferior patient-reported outcome measures at 2 years, though accelerated bone bridge formation signals a biological response requiring longer follow-up. One limitation: retrospective design at a single center with no standardized intraoperative measurement of resection percentage introduces significant classification error between groups. Facet resection of 50% or greater during posterior cervical foraminotomy produced equivalent visual analog scale and neck disability index improvements to less than 50% resection at 2 years, though bone bridge formation was significantly higher at 66.7% versus 26.3% with p less than 0.01. Moving on, Zhang and colleagues published in JSES a retrospective cohort titled Ultrasound Shear Wave Elastography Derived Tissue Stiffness Predicts Intraarticular Lesions of the Long Head of the Biceps Tendon. They enrolled 71 patients and evaluated whether preoperative shear wave elastography derived shear modulus values could predict intraarticular long head of biceps tendon lesion severity using a four-type arthroscopic classification in patients with unilateral rotator cuff tears. This extends prior work on ultrasound elastography for tendon pathology assessment by applying delta shear modulus as a normalized metric that accounts for individual baseline stiffness variation, moving beyond absolute stiffness values used in earlier studies and validating findings against intraoperative arthroscopic classification. One limitation: the four-type arthroscopic classification used lacks universal standardization, limiting reproducibility and cross-study comparison of the diagnostic thresholds reported. Preoperative shear wave elastography, delta shear modulus of the long head of biceps tendon proximal to the bicipital groove correlates strongly with arthroscopic lesion severity with rho equals 0.750, with a diagnostic threshold greater than 14 distinguishing normal from frayed tendon. Moving on, Fang and colleagues published in the Spine Journal a retrospective cohort titled The Effect of Paraspinal Sarcopenia on Postoperative Sagittal Balance, a Multivariate Analysis Following Multilevel Lumbar Fusion Surgery. They enrolled 213 patients and examined whether preoperative paraspinal sarcopenia, defined by psoas muscle index thresholds of less than 6.36 square centimeters per square meter in men and less than 3.92 square centimeters per square meter in women, predicts sagittal alignment and functional outcomes after multilevel posterior lumbar interbody fusion with minimum two-year postoperative follow-up. This extends Debo's 2024 work by identifying preoperative multifidus fat infiltration and atrophy as modifiable upstream contributors to the sagittal malalignment that drives poor outcomes. One limitation: the retrospective cross-sectional design precludes determining whether sarcopenia causes sagittal imbalance or whether pre-existing sagittal malalignment drives progressive muscle degeneration, leaving causality unresolved. Multifidus atrophy and fat infiltration are independent risk factors for postoperative sagittal imbalance after multilevel posterior lumbar interbody fusion, while psoas and erector spiny metrics are